From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how the restaurant industry is handling the latest COVID restrictions. Also, we look back on one of Michigan's newer industries that also turned out to be a banger for 2020, recreational cannabis.
Cannabis is one of those interesting products. It kind of just sells itself. People are willing to pay for it what they feel it's worth.
If you've set up a desk in the basement, health officials are warning now's the time to double check for radon.
Can be a localized issue where one house in a neighborhood can have elevated levels and the rest may not, or it can be whole neighborhoods.
Plus, the bizarro world winners of pandemic football.
Nothing really is expected of Michigan State this year. Nothing. And you beat Michigan, you own the Paul Bunyan Trophy, and you just beat the second best team in the Big Ten, 5-0, 13th ranked Northwestern. Those are two of the best wins you could have had.
All that coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. It's been 1 year since the legal recreational cannabis industry got up and running in Michigan. So how is that economy faring?
It never slowed down. It just kept growing and growing and growing. Every single month of sales in adult use has been bigger than the month before.
Cannabis is one of those interesting products that it kind of just sells itself. And people are willing to pay for it what they feel it's worth.
We'll find out later in the show, but first, a hearing is scheduled today for the lawsuit challenging Michigan's restrictions on indoor dining. Restaurants are once again under orders to serve no customers indoors. The state reinstated these orders as COVID cases have been making their second spike. Hospitals all around the state are filling up, and medical professionals are begging folks to stay home, wear the mask, and order takeout if they patronize a restaurant. But there are restaurant owners who say the latest restrictions on dine-in service could very well kill their businesses in a year when many have already closed. Over the weekend, the owners of the Southeast Michigan Italian food chain Andiamo encouraged fellow owners to reject Governor Whitmer's administration's rules and keep their dine-in service. With us now is Susan Zaleski, food industry reporter for the Detroit Free Press, who's been following this. Susan, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The letter from the owners of Andiamo, Joe and Rosalie Vicari, was not made public. Can you tell us, for those who haven't seen your story yet, about what the letter said and who did receive it?
Well, it was directed to, it came out about more than a week ago. The letter was dated November 24th, and it was directed towards the, the restaurant owners and those in the industry about the how the recent shutdown is hurting their business. And, according to the letter, want to be able to do something about it and be heard. They are saying that this shutdown just really, really is, a lot of restaurants will not be will not come back from it.
What do we know about their region and how restaurants in the state have been faring there?
They own they have 25 restaurants under their umbrella. They're a big group. During the pandemic, they reopened as many of them did as they were allowed to, and then before that they were doing takeout. As many restaurants were. So they do have a lot of restaurants. And I believe, according to Crane's report, they employ about 700 people in the area.
Yeah, that's a lot. Have you been able to tell if any restaurants are taking them up on their suggestion and trying to ignore the state's restrictions?
No, none of them have, that I know have said so. There's a lot of the restaurants are aware of this letter. I'm not sure. I think part of it is waiting on an outcome from the ruling, the hearing today, which the hearing took place this morning and is now over with. But there's been no decision, made on what the MRLA, the Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association, is arguing that their federal rights have been violated.
Sure. What do we know about whether there are other restaurants in the state that might have unofficially tried to take matters into their own hands and keep dine-in service going?
Okay, well, there was a couple of them recently that my colleague Mark Curley and Chick reported on that, they, defied the order and remained open. And on Friday, they were fined by the state. They were issued citations. I believe some of them, their liquor licenses were suspended. So they, they were fined and for defying the order and staying open.
You wrote recently also about a big inflatable Grinch character outside of the Turago restaurant in Trenton that was labeled Gretch the Grinch. When you talk to restaurant owners, what kinds of things do they say about the restrictions that they're facing right now?
Well, some of them said, for instance, the Tarago owner, he's been following, he said, most of them, I should say, they're following, the capacity orders, the orders for the sanitation orders and things like that, that they are doing, whatever they can.
They are complying with the law.
Complying with the order,
Sure.
not the re the re I mean the you know prior to the this 3 week pause that we're currently in.
And the would you say that the industry lawsuit and the frustration that's represented there, do you have any anecdotal sense of how many people do think that it's kind of crazy that you can go get a haircut right now, but you cannot dine in even under physically distanced conditions.
Yeah, that's a lot of their arguments is that they malls are open, other businesses are open. The restaurant industry is, it has been hard hit. I mean, it's been, reported, all along how hard hit they've been, and 2,000 restaurants have closed, and they're expecting if this, continues that another, 4,000 restaurants could, possibly close permanently
Yeah.
because of this.
There have been a couple of videos that have gone viral online that have shown restaurants packed with people. And obviously, like you say, these are not the majority of Michigan's restaurants, but just a few places where, maybe mask wearing is not observed among all staff and customers, might not be very strongly encouraged to wear masks as they move about the place of business. What have you been able to find out about whether the threat of COVID is becoming, I mean, how many businesses have been involved in super spreader type events?
That I don't know. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services is pointing out that there are 64, I believe the number is 64 outbreaks tied to restaurants. However, the MRL, the Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association says that only 4% of cases can be attributed to restaurants.
When you look at the kind of sanctions that the Whitmer administration has levied against businesses that have tried to stay open, the fines, we hear that the Attorney General's office has threatened to pull liquor licenses. Are these the kind of punishments that might have serious repercussions about the life of a business? Or do you think that there are some business owners who might just take it as the cost of what they have to do to get by right now?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't know if I can comment on that. I mean, they clearly have been fines all along. There was fines, against capacity, I believe, that was fined by MyOSHA earlier this summer. So, restaurants, I mean, they have, clearly last week they, several were fined.
As we mentioned, that lawsuit had its hearing today in which the Restaurant and Lodging Association was challenging the restrictions. Did the judge give any indication about when there might be a ruling for that?
No, he did not. I mean, they were presented, they were at a hearing presenting their cases.
Was there anything else that you've noticed as you've watched how restaurants around the state have been trying to cope with this?
No, I mean, a lot of them just, you know, some of the restaurants that I've talked to all along are, they're, you know, doing what they can. They're, you know, they're pivoting to, you know, they've pivoted to takeout. They've, you know, they're following the guidance that that's been set, you know, put forth to them.
Susan Selasky covers the restaurant industry for the Detroit Free Press. Susan, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
We have a couple of somber updates from the weekend. The first is that Wayne County Sheriff Benny Napoleon has been admitted to a hospital and put on a ventilator just a couple of days after announcing he tested positive for COVID-19. If you're not from the region, you may know Sheriff Napoleon's name best as the main challenger against Mike Duggan for mayor of Detroit in 2013. Vigils are being held in the city to pray for his recovery. Sheriff Napoleon joins a growing list of law enforcement officials and officers who've become gravely ill due to the disease. Some of the earliest reported deaths in Wayne County were among the police and sheriff's departments. Benny Napoleon's daughter wrote on social media, her father is not losing his fight with COVID. In the Upper Peninsula, a former lawmaker did lose a 2-year battle with lung cancer. Former state senator Tom Casperson. Sitting officials from the UP call him a giant in the region. Tom Casperson was 61. Coming up, we'll talk about a new workplace hazard that many of us didn't anticipate before this year, radon in basement home offices.
Radon's a naturally occurring, colorless, odorless radioactive gas that gets into our home through cracks and voids in the foundation, and there it can build up over time to unsafe levels.
That's after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The University of Michigan's football team has announced it will hold practice virtually, whatever that means, as they have presumptive positive COVID tests among team members. If you've been watching Michigan football lately, you know this is more in a string of disappointments for the team in 2020. And there's enough grief to go around this holiday season. Joining us now to talk about all the latest, the best, the worst, is John U. Bacon, Michigan Radio sports commentator. Hi, John.
Hello there, April.
So let's start out with Michigan. What do we know about infections on the team at this point?
Not much. Nothing's been released yet. We know that they've got some concern about it, which tells you they must have some positives. The question is how many. And there are pretty strict Big Ten guidelines as to what the rules are about that. 5% on the team is enough to trigger a lot. So at that point, you're not playing.
I am still so mystified. What does virtual practice even mean?
Not much. Does that make it easier? It's like a virtual concert. Not the same. We're going to think about football, a walkthrough, of course. It's probably mainly chalk talk is my guess. No one really knows. We're Wild West these days, April. Everything's new.
Just one more challenge in what was already a not great week for Jim Harbaugh. This is a coach who came in with such high fan expectations. Where do things stand with his job security right now?
Only two guys know that, sadly, and that is Jim Harbaugh and Ward Manuel, the athletic director at Michigan, his boss. And neither one's said a peep on this. However, you got to be dumb not to look at this and say Michigan lost to an 0-5 team for the first time in its 141-year history. That gets headlines, of course. Michigan State has won only one game until this past weekend. We'll probably get to that. It's been a pretty horrible season, and not just the 2-4 record, but how they're getting blown out by teams like Indiana, like Wisconsin. Showing very little energy, offense and defense both seem to be at times, most of the time, in disarray. So what it comes down to now is the big bet. Harbaugh has 1 year left on his contract, and you can't recruit with 1 year left because parents will say you won't be around in 3 or 4 years. So you either have to re-up Harbaugh for 5 years and his assistant coaches or new assistant coaches, and that's about a $20 million investment in a year when they've lost, you know, $20, $30, $40 million from their budget. So there's your bet, and that's not a very safe one.
Yeah, I mean, I feel for the university, this is not a great time to have any kind of certainty about anything, much less, you know, what you'd like to do long term for the program. Do you think there's a possibility for an amicable separation for Jim Harbaugh?
That is the most likely scenario right now, near as I am guessing. And anybody tells you they know what's going on, and they're not Jim Harbaugh, and they're not Ward Emanuel, are either lying or stupid, April. So,
Or selling something,
yes, or very smart. Who knows?
Right.
But right now, he will not. Nothing will happen midseason. It never does at Michigan. Not even Brady Hoke, not even Rich Rodriguez got fired midseason. It's not happening. I don't see Jim getting fired at the end of the season either. What might happen is, as you describe, an amicable parting. I know of at least three or four NFL teams who are interested in Jim Harbaugh right now. So that right now, and those odds go up with every bad weekend, including, of course, right now, COVID.
I understand that there is a job opening in Detroit at the moment.
Yes, there is, April.
Are you talking about the Lions? Do you think they might be interested?
I think they might. Look, I mean, Jim Harbaugh only had 4 years in the NFL. Of those 4 years, the first three, he got an otherwise horrible San Francisco team to the conference finals 3 years in a row and within a play of winning a Super Bowl. So they don't really care about the college ranks. So none of this really matters. So he's still going to be a hot property. The Lions would be foolish not to consider him, I would say. That was a horrible situation finally ending is what happened in Detroit over the weekend. But that job, Chicago possibly, New York Jets are horrible. The Texans, who just beat Detroit, they are mm-hmm. still so horrible, they still want a new coach. So there are four possibilities right there.
So after a stinging defeat on Thanksgiving for the Lions, Matt Patricia and the Ford family have parted ways. Do you think that Matt Patricia could have held on to his job much longer if he'd won that game, or was this all just a foregone conclusion?
Another week. mm-hmm. I think that he is going to be gone at the end of this year almost no matter what. And now it's coming out that he treated his players poorly. Jonathan Crick, friend of mine for the Toronto Sun who covers the NFL, he said he treated his players like replaceable goldfish you care little about and leave in a small bowl full of dirty water near a corner window of an ever dark room. Not very appealing. So he was going to be gone in December, if not November. You don't really gain much by firing him now because you want to lose as many games you can before the draft. But it lets everyone know that enough's enough. And Sheila Ford Hemp, of course, the daughter of Martha Ford. She made the call and clearly the right one.
Was there any indication that the way the players were feeling about Matt Patricia had anything to do with his ouster?
We don't know that yet. The Ford family is famously taciturn about this, not unlike Michigan football, of course, so we don't know. But they've got their finger on the pulse. They'd be foolish not to be aware of that after 2.5 years. So I think that had to be a factor. If the players were still fighting for him and they said, look, don't do it, we're going to turn a corner, you have to listen. But if they're saying we're done with this guy and we're going to play like it, what else is there left?
Right. So here we are, and the team that looks least bad in the state right now is Michigan State, which just beat a ranked Northwestern football team. Now, in this situation, Mel Tucker is still coaching players who mostly came on to play for Mark D'Antonio. He's had mixed results so far this season. What do you make of Mel Tucker in this position?
That they are playing for him. That the, 1-4 record, I believe, going into the weekend did not deter them. Look, I mean, as you said, D'Antonio had kind of mailed it in the last 2 years. The team was going down. Recruiting was going down. The cupboard is almost entirely bare, frankly, at East Lansing. As you and I had said when the season restarted, that nothing really is expected of Michigan State this year. And you beat Michigan, you own the Paul Bunyan Trophy, and you just beat the second-best team in the Big Ten, 5-0, 13th-ranked Northwestern. Those are two of the best wins you could have had. So they're clearly fighting for a new coach. That is a very promising sign going forward for Michigan State. And in the meantime, they're already having a better year than Michigan. You could have won a lot of money on that one, April, a couple months ago.
The thing that I keep wondering about this year is conditions have been so extraordinary, both at the collegiate level and within the NFL. Do you think expectations are where they should be for players and coaches, given that we're still in the middle of a pandemic, despite some teams and franchises' interest in, you know, ignoring that, virtually ignoring that fact.
That is a great point, and 2 points. A, COVID is, I think, a very big factor with all these situations. And two, it has been largely ignored, even dismissed. That you're going to see a lot of teams have bad years this year and come back just fine next year. And possibly Michigan's one of them. I'm sure that's part of the thinking that Ward Manuel has got to figure in to make his decision in December. But again, the poor guy, he's got to decide for the next 5 years now. And that's a tough, tough place to be in. But I think this whole year, I mean, for everything, I don't care if your kid's in you know, elementary school like yours or high school or college, corporations, you name it, the whole year is kind of a write-off. And how would that not apply to the NFL and college football? It seems presumptuous not to include it. So I think you're right.
John Hubakin is the author of Overtime, Jim Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines at the Crossroads of College Football and the Great Halifax Explosion, if you're looking for some decent reads over the holidays. John, it's great talking to you. Thanks for checking in.
April, always a pleasure. Thank you.
A lot of us have created basement offices to take refuge in ever since the pandemic hit Michigan in earnest back in March. Seems like an easy way to stay safe from COVID-19 while getting some work done. But whether or not we're aware of it, there may be a risk to working in your basement. And that's radon. After all, 1 in 4 homes here have some kind of radon problem. Joining us now is Michigan's radon specialist, Aaron Behrendt, with the state's Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy, also known as EAGLE. Aaron Behrendt, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you about the radon issue in the state of Michigan.
Hey, first of all, could you give us the primer? What is radon and where does it come from?
Well, radon is a naturally occurring, colorless, odorless radioactive gas that gets into our home through cracks and voids in the foundation, and there it can build up over time to unsafe levels. Unfortunately, there's no short-term side effects, so the body can't sense high levels of radon, but it is a carcinogen. It causes lung cancer over long-term exposure. Dr. Field from the University of Iowa College of Public Health states that radon is a leading environmental cause of cancer mortality in the United States.
Why is it that Michigan, it's so prevalent in Michigan?
Well, it's naturally occurring. Uranium's naturally occurring in the soil, and as uranium's radioactive, so it decays, it breaks down over time into an element called radium, and then radium then breaks down into radon, and in gas form, it's mobile. It can move through the soil and get into the home that way.
Aaron, when one brings up radon in discussion, sometimes, you know, people might think, oh, that's more of an East Coast problem. But it sounds like Michigan's levels may be comparable with other parts of the country that have a radon problem. First of all, is that correct?
That is correct. It's a worldwide issue. Radon is everywhere, and it's not going anywhere. We need to deal with it. We actually have elevated concentrations in every one of our counties, so it's a statewide issue that we need to worry about.
Are there counties that have particularly high concentrations?
There are. You know, we've collected test results over 20-some years. And what that data has shown that Branch County, 53% of the test results have come back elevated. Hillsdale's at 52%. Lenawee's at 50%. But again, our hotspot is in the UP, Marquette County, actually. We have had a test result come back in Marquette County at over 458 picocuries per liter.
Wow. So, I mean, some of this is just a geologic function.
It is. Again, it's just uranium naturally present in the soil, and as that breaks down, it can be a localized issue where one house in a neighborhood can have elevated levels and the rest may not, or it can be whole neighborhoods. So that's why we encourage everyone to test, regardless of where you live, regardless of age of the home or type of foundation. The only way to know is to test your home.
So if you are one of those thousands of people who set up an office in the basement this year and you're talking to a neighbor who mentions there's definitely radon in the neighborhood, what's the first step? Is it that test kit?
Yes, the first test would be testing your home. And depending on your comfort level, We distribute test kits to the local health departments every year. We also have an agreement with one of the test kit manufacturers that you can go to the website mi.radon.com and order your test kit, and it can be shipped directly to you. So you don't have that person-to-person contact during this time. You can have a test kit shipped right to you. Or if you're not, if you don't feel comfortable testing your own home, you can have a professional come in and do that for you.
So is there a difference between doing the one-day test and the one that's performed over an extended period of time?
Well, any valid test needs to be for at least 48 hours. But the longer test can be more indicative of your long-term exposure to radon. But initially, we would like you to screen your radon levels. So we would encourage testing with a short-term test kit first. So at least 48 hours, usually it's a 3 to 7 day test. And then from that point, depending on your test results, you know, you could go to more of a long-term test depending on what those initial levels were. If somebody's test results come back too high, you know, I would say 8 picocuries per liter or above, then I wouldn't consider long-term testing. At that point, we'd encourage confirmation test to make sure that first test was valid, and then fixing the home at that point if that first elevated test was confirmed.
Those magic words, fixing the home. Is there a way to make a basement safe if you do get, you know, a confirmed positive radon test?
Yes, and it's very easy to do. It's called installing a mitigation system. It uses active soil depressurization, which is a fancy term for providing a negative pressure underneath the home, a suction point, and then venting that outside. So basically, a mitigation system is a suction point on the inside of the foundation that grabs the radon and other soil gas before it gets a chance to get into the home. And then you vent it outside where it's safe. And radon can dissipate very quickly in outdoor air. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a suction point and PVC pipe routed from that suction point up and outside the home. A radon fan will be installed on the outside of the home. And then PVC pipe will be routed above the roof line so it can exhaust in a safe area. That fan runs all the time. It basically is removing that radon gas before it gets a chance to get into the home.
You know, you walk into a basement, it's, you know, it's very well done. It's been refinished. Everything looks new. Is recent construction necessarily an indicator that a home would not have radon? Or do you sometimes find homes that have very built out basement environments that still have a radon problem?
Yeah, it really doesn't matter. Anything in contact with the soil can have a potential radon issue. It's really whether that uranium is naturally present in the soil next to the foundation or not. That's why we say it doesn't matter the age of the home, type of foundation. If it's in contact with the soil, it could potentially have a radon issue.
Mm. So does that mean that a person might reasonably think to themselves, well, I'm just not going to worry about this. I think I'll just move my office up to, you know, a higher floor in my house, maybe upstairs.
The issue with that is we do have higher concentrations in our basement because it's closer to the source. That's where it enters the home. But with forced air furnaces and, you know, in the wintertime when we got our home closed up tight, you know, and there's that stack effect. Hot air rises within the structure and it actually moves throughout the home. So it will be slightly less as you move up floors. But again, it's important to test the home to realize, you know, if it's an issue. Radon's in every home. So it's not a matter of if it's present. It's a matter of, are they high enough that I should do something about it? And testing is the only way to go, only way to know.
During the pandemic, there are an awful lot of people who've lost income in their families, and Michiganders are really having to reprioritize their budgets this winter. How important is radon on the priority list?
That's a very good question. Obviously, you know, putting food on the table, fixing the roof is immediate things that should be considered. Radon is a little bit more long term, but it is a serious health risk. It is a carcinogen. So, you know, I understand the need to prioritize for sure. Generally speaking, fixing the home costs between $800 and $1,500, depending on, you know, how the home is built, just to give you an idea of cost.
Are there any assistance plans that the state has available to help people with this?
The state doesn't currently have assistance plans, but there are from the federal government. The USDA has some, EPA has some, and I think Housing and Urban Development have some programs. You know, for more information, we're here to help. For more information, they can call 1-800-RADON-GAS or Radon Hotline for help. Email me at radon@michigan.gov or go to our website, michigan.gov/radon. And again, we're here to help. If you have any questions about radon testing, testing protocols, fixing the home, you have questions about maybe some quotes you got from contractors, we can help you go through some of that. So we're here to help.
Aaron Berndt is the state's radon specialist. Aaron, thank you for your time.
Thanks, April. Again, it's a pleasure to be on your show and to share this information with the public.
Just one final note. The state of Michigan does recommend fixing home radon problems if concentrations are at or above the EPA action level. Up next, it's been just about a year since Michigan's dispensaries rolled out recreational cannabis offerings.
It never slowed down. It just kept growing and growing and growing. Every single month of sales in adult use has been bigger than the month before.
We'll hear from a reporter covering the industry about how things have changed since then. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. It has been 1 year since Michigan enacted the plan for legalizing sale and use of cannabis for recreational purposes following the voters' directive. It appears that Michiganders have seized on the chance to take the edge off one of the more hellacious years in living memory. Sales of recreational cannabis are closing in on $500 million. Dustin Walsh, senior reporter at Crain's Detroit, has had an eye on this sector, and he joins us now. Dustin, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you.
So when you think back on this first year of legalized recreational sales in Michigan, what are your initial thoughts?
Well, I think in the beginning, you know, it was always a question of whether the regulated market competes with the kind of illicit market, the illegal market, black market, whatever you'd like to call it. And it was pretty evident early on that it could. And then, early on, COVID hit in March, and that was always sort of a question mark of discretionary spending. But with the stimulus dollars and gratuitous unemployment at the time, it never slowed down and just kept growing and growing and growing. Every single month of sales in adult use has been bigger than the month before over the past year. So I think just how relentless the market has been sort of the surprise of it all.
And the state did make that decision to deem cannabis essential during this time. In hindsight, do you think that was a good move?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're looking at it from a sales standpoint, the marijuana businesses were able to adapt really quickly. And that clearly kept sales up. Obviously, if they had shut them down, sales would have gone nowhere. And I think from a regulatory standpoint, what you're looking at is you would have pushed people that are users of the drug right back into the illicit market. So I think it is a smart move to keep the stores open and to keep people, doing what's easiest. You know, people want to do the easiest thing, and the easiest thing is to go to your local shop and buy marijuana.
I mean, one of the things that just feels so striking about this was not just that sales were big, but sales were big from the get-go. In the very first week, Michiganders bought $5.7 million worth of product. I mean, have you ever seen anything like this?
Well, no, I haven't covered any industries that just kind of cropped up out of nowhere, right? this is the first one that I've been able to see from its infancy. So I haven't seen anything like this, and it's been really eye opening. I think when you really look at it, you weren't sure what sort of businesses were really going to come out of this, and whether it was going to be full of basically a bunch of really poor businessmen trying to that love cannabis and trying to operate businesses. And I think what we've learned is there is some of that, of course. But I think what we've learned is it's they're really sophisticated business people running really sophisticated businesses that just happen to sell marijuana.
Do you think the sales have hit peak yet?
No, not even close. Mm-hmm. We have upwards of 120 to 160 current shops open. Only 84 municipalities are even opted in to allow adult recreational use. So there's a long runway. People are still driving from a long distances if they don't have a shop near them to access the legal market if they choose to. So I think when you really see the market come on board more, I think hitting $1 billion even next year might be a reality.
To that end, Dustin, can we talk for just a minute about Detroit's particular situation?
Sure.
The city made a slow start with a stated intention of opening up opportunities for vendors who are people of color. And council has just within the past 9 days passed a plan for who gets to apply for a license and the terms under which those new businesses will operate. Is that one of the things you're talking about? Like, what would you expect to happen once more shops get opened in Detroit?
Right. I mean, obviously, Detroit's the big market, right? The big money market that everyone wanted access to. It's a very strong medical marijuana market. And so all those medical marijuana shops were really looking forward to being able to be both, play in both areas. And they were not able to for a considerable amount of time. Having Detroit open is definitely going to benefit the overall industry. The side of it that has been, trying to, people that have been impacted, people of color that have been impacted by drug laws, that has never really been solved. And they're really trying to get that in place. If you talk to the executive director of the Michigan Regulatory Agency, they will admit that they've sort of failed in that area. I don't remember the exact numbers, but they had quite a few people apply through their program, and they were only able to bring 8 of them to actual licensure. So that's not a good number, and that's not a good thing. So we'll see what Detroit can do. But really, that's the real big piece of the puzzle that needs to be solved. And I think once that's solved, you will definitely see an increase in sales, and you'll see an increase in everything else. But big business marijuana is still going to get stronger and stronger. And so it'll be tough in the long haul, in my opinion, for the smaller players, no matter what.
We've talked to retailers who are people of color who say that access to capital is still a really huge issue since cannabis is still not something that the federal government recognizes as part of trade in the traditional sense. Do you think that Detroit is in a position to find any new gears on helping people get past that barrier?
Yes and no. I mean, that doesn't matter what the business is. Access to capital for people of color and small businesses has always been a problem. It's been a problem for as long as people have been starting businesses. No one seems to have that solution quite at hand. I do think because of the focus on Detroit, and particularly you've seen a lot of big banks throw a lot of money and a little more access into the city of Detroit in the last 5 years. So I think that will definitely move the needle. I also think Detroit has a lot of opportunity with in particular Black-owned banks. Once that market kind of opens up and they're allowed to play in that space, I think that'll also move the needle. I think there's a definite need for that. So I really do think you're going to see that blossom, but it is going to take time. And in opening up that market is always going to be difficult because so much of what's out there now are people that have lots of money. And historically, that hasn't been for people of color when it comes to starting small businesses, is having access to that. So opening that up is going to be tricky, but I do believe Detroit is primed for that to happen in the long run.
Sure. Dustin, there are some states that legalized cannabis for recreational use that just experienced massive flooding in the market when sales became legal. Why didn't that happen here?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question. Yes, and you're talking of Oregon specifically, California as well. At one point, I believe Oregon had enough growth of marijuana that it was 4 times what they could sell, which meant that basically it was leaving the state illegally. Michigan was a much slower rollout. It took some time, and there's some benefits to that. The slow rollout kind of makes everyone a little antsy. But because the licensure was slow and because the capital requirements were sort of high, it made everything move a little slower and it didn't flood the market. I think there is going to be a point, probably in the next year or two, probably closer to 2 years, where you are going to see the kind of saturation of the market. And that's when, you'll see consolidation, you'll see other things. So it's really important for kind of people to get on the entry floor now. But you are going to see, more and more product hit the market. And lower prices. And we will see a little bit of what's gone on in other states, but certainly not to that degree. When you talk to people within the industry, they're actually quite complimentary of our regulatory system here, that it was so methodical and that it was so slow and really didn't hit all the pitfalls that other states hit.
Just one last question, Dustin. There was a lot of concern early on about who was really going to benefit from this. Was it going to be Michiganders, with local businesses, or would out-of-state money end up getting most of the business? What's the statewide picture on that right now?
So right now it's sort of a mix. So obviously you are seeing out of state money kind of flowing in the way that it has to operate because of the you know, it's illegal federally. So they have to kind of, you know, route their money here and be based here. So you'll see that change as more states come online, and particularly if you know, it becomes legal federally. But right now you've got sort of this, everyone can kind of play in the space, right? You've got really, really high end product that sells for a ridiculous amount of money, and people are trying things out. And you've got other companies that are smaller. I talked to one company where they're coming out with a product called Good Nuff, which is sort of a play on words. But the whole idea is they want to be the Miller High Life of marijuana, to where it's just like a utility beer, but utility weed for people that partake.
Lawnmower weed?
There you go. Lawnmower weed. That's exactly right. And so that's sort of the space that we're hitting. And so, you know, the reality is you have to have money to play in the space though, still. You know, you can't just set up a fruit stand on the corner and sell marijuana. You know, there's a lot more to it, and you have to have money to enter that market. So it's still, you know, toward the high end. But I do think as this goes on, the bigger ones are going to consolidate. And so that'll be kind of whether we have a fraction of really big and really small, kind of operations is going to be what we look for in the future, I think.
Dustin Walsh, senior reporter for Crain's Detroit. Dustin, thanks so much.
Thank you, April.
For a frontline view of the first year of recreational sales, we're inviting Marie King to join us. She works at Bloom City Club with locations at Battle Creek, Burton, and Ann Arbor. Marie, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think were some of the things that the team learned about doing business during a pandemic?
Definitely we had to take a lot of our moves from the state itself because we were considered a industry that was allowed to stay open during the pandemic. We were given lots of guidelines to be able to do that safely. Mm-hmm. So we learned a lot about working together to try to maintain those standards to keep everybody safe. And that was a real learning curve, of course, because in the cannabis industry, we really try to pride ourselves on being very hands-on and very helpful and compassionate towards people. So this was very different.
Do you think that there were things that needed to change from the initial business plan because of this being a year when people, you know, at some points couldn't even walk in your door?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the issue is that a lot of people who are getting into cannabis initially for medicinal reasons really do need some guiding. They need some help. They need to be able to come in and talk to a bud tender. And of course, for a while, we weren't able to do that. We had a curbside pickup only policy going on for a while, and our actual shop was closed down, the inside of the shop. But we were able to field calls over the phone and help people. It was very different. The level of care that we're used to was still there, but we had to be more creative about how we were able to help people that way.
Sure. Do you think that you mentioned that some of the people who come to you for product now first came to cannabis as a medicinal remedy? Do you think that legalization did attract some customers, though, for recreational cannabis that weren't already interested in the market?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially from neighboring states. There are, of course, states around Michigan that do not have access to cannabis, no legal access to cannabis. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of people in these other states who are probably looking at cannabis as a possible medication for one reason or another and wanted to come and try it. So within the state of Michigan, there's definitely been a little bit more of an interest because now people don't have to go and get the card, which was a concern for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Now all you need to be is over the age of 21 and have some sort of proof that you are, just like with buying alcohol.
What were some of the bigger challenges you think that Bloom City faced this year?
Oh, definitely COVID-19 was one of the bigger challenges. Absolutely. The other is that in order to make the transition from a medical state to a medical and recreational state, a lot of new policies and regulations had to be put into place. For one thing, there is an entire tracking system for cannabis from seed to sale. So there is a lot of oversight that goes into the process of just getting cannabis products to a store for people to purchase.
Was sourcing an issue? We know that since sales were so robust that a number of retailers were just having trouble getting hands on any product, much less tracking, you know, the products that they could get.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And the state has thrown a couple of curveballs our direction. For a long time, people were able to get cannabis products from caregivers, who were people who were legally allowed to, by the state, to grow cannabis for other people, other medical marijuana patients. And that became something that they couldn't do anymore. So there are rules and regulations that were put into place that were part of the original recreational law. And now we're seeing a lot more of an adjustment to how it's going to be from now on, which is a lot more regulation than what we were used to in the medical cannabis community, to be frank.
Yeah. One of the ways in which this business was unique is that it has a higher sales tax than a lot of other things. Do you think that that 16% number, do you think that put any kind of damper on sales?
Maybe a little bit, but cannabis is one of those interesting products that it kind of just sells itself, and people are willing to pay for it what they feel it's worth. Definitely the taxation has been a little bit of a sticker price shock for a lot of people because, you know, nobody's really expecting to be paying an excise tax of 10% on top of a 6% sales tax. And it has been a little bit of a shock for people, but I think a lot of others are just so grateful for the ability to have access, legal access to this product, that maybe they're able to shrug off that 16% sales tax.
Bloom City is in a place where you've been able to expand this year. I believe the Battle Creek location is the newest one, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure that the team had eyes on what colleagues in other places were experiencing. Are there things that you think happened in Michigan with recreational sales that maybe didn't happen in other places?
I would say so. Yeah. A lot of the other states that went recreational are out on closer to the West Coast. And Michigan is in, you know, this very northern pocket of the Midwest. And even though I think it's Illinois that also has recreational, but they've been having a lot of issues getting product available to people. So Michigan has kind of been carrying the weight of the demand for cannabis. And that's been pretty intense. And I think that that's helped buoy the industry quite a bit. I don't think it's going to last. I think we're seeing a nice, sweet influx of interest right now. And then eventually, I think that we're going to see more states leaning towards either medical programs or recreational programs. And then the availability will just be greater.
Marie King is with Bloom City Club, with locations in Ann Arbor and Burton and Battle Creek. Marie, we really appreciate your time. Thank you for telling us about this crazy year.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. The executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. We appreciate you being here. See you tomorrow.